Hello and welcome to the Culturefile debate, which this time is coming to you from the very first Beta Digital Arts Festival at the Digital Hub in Dublin's Liberties, is what I said last year on this occasion, when we were gathered after a weekend of performances, screenings, exhibitions, workshops and panels at Beta 23 to discuss AI with some of its users and some of its shapers. At that time, we were 1 year into the high season of generative AI, ChatGPT, which became public on November the 30th, 2022, was then in the wild. Back last year, we were all so young then. We were confused, excited, fascinated with an unmissable vein of fear about what this would all mean. But luckily, since then, the picture has resolved and our futures become clear and shining bright. Psych. So this year, now that everything is shaken down and the path revealed itself, we've gathered our panel again to see where it all went right in their own work and for humanity. Since the introduction of desktop publishing, when sections of the print world found itself de-skilled, we often experience that feeling that things were now in the hands of the amateur. The company who brought freshly baked bread to petrol stations used to boast that their cuisine had successfully de-skilled baking. But you only have to look at the explosion of artisan bakeries to see that the de-skilled bakery wave collapsed, as though de-skilling might be the best way to learn the value of skill. Will we have to de-skill art to go post-design in order to make the same discovery? I might suggest we are in some ways down that path already. As we learn more about our relationship with machine learning, is the post-design future more design? So let's introduce our panel. Joanna Walsh, who is an author, designer, and a familiar voice from her essays on Culturefile and also a collaborator with AIs, particularly in her project Miscommunication.
I was actually a creator of that AI as well.
Tell me more.
Well, it was actually in the era when it was super easy to, well, relatively easy to put together an AI from open source GPT-2 material. This is 2020. So, you know, unlike nowadays when it's very, very difficult to get into this stuff, it's not open source anymore. So I think that's one big thing that's changed.
I'm going to ask you more about that in a moment. Leon Butler is an artist, program, and designer who frequently works with machine learning technologies, creating gallery and theatre work, notably the performance Dwelling, seen at last year's festival. And lately, he's been enlisting machine learning to explore the environmental precarity of island peoples. Good day, Leon.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Noam Jungratson is a communication designer and speculative design theorist who co-organizes the Ghent-based queer publishing collective Bebe Books, which they say involves collective strategies of publishing that challenge the modern myth of the heroic designer. And his speculative work recently has been using the medium of biscuits to think about new relationships with AI. Hi, Noam.
Hello.
Have you any biscuits with you today?
Well, unfortunately, it was lost in the transportation.
Really?
No, I mean, I didn't.
They're very crumbly. Always a problem. So I wanted to begin by asking all of you a quick question to just get a feel of what's happened to us in the last year. So we've all ingested a lot more data sets, even if, as Joanna's been suggesting, we haven't been able to specifically fiddle around in the way we used to with the machine learning tools. But personally, we've all ingested a lot more data sets. So I wonder, what didn't you know about working with AI last year that you'd prefer if you didn't know now, Leon?
I still think that there's like the labeling of AIs is really troublesome. And I lecture as well. And I you know, work in a university and people keep saying, what are we going to do about AI? And they're very unspecific about what they mean. I'm like, is it large language models you have a problem with? Is it image generation? You know, what is it, this kind of group term or group think for everything? There's no specificity in it. So I have to ask people, what part of it is it that you have a problem with? So what I didn't know last year is that no one really understands what it is. Everyone's afraid of it because they don't. And suddenly we have like a really big problem with it, especially in academia. Like a couple of years ago, everyone used Grammarly on their work, you know, to check their spelling, check their grammar. And its tagline is your AI writing assistant. But if someone suggests that they use an LLM to, you know, proof their work now, then that's, you know, a problem. And, you know, we have academic policies against that. So it's just the lack of specificity in what they mean is becoming really problematic, I think.
You were doing it a little bit there, but just draw out what you would mean when you talk about machine learning, which I think is your preferred term. That still covers a few kind of affordances, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's definitely like parts of that, like, you know, having GANs or, you know, training an adversarial network or, you know, neural networks and different parts in that that are really useful, you know, in those areas. I think it's just the blanket term for a computer helping you with something, or, you know, an AI is something that doing a task that would be normally completed by someone. It's just, you know, it goes back so far, and everything that we're doing in spell check, in spam filters, all of those things are using that technology, but it's got a new name that's, you know, very buzzy. And I feel like we're, as artists, doing a lot of work for VCs, for finance companies who are like fundraising in it, and they're going like, this is an amazing thing, and look at this beautiful work that's being made by artists. We're not really seeing the kickback on that in terms of like funding or money or anything like that, but there's definitely a lot of companies who are, because we're in this, you know, AI summer sort of part, that they're getting loads of funding. But I feel like we're slightly being the foot soldiers, you know, bringing it forward, and it's how the public can identify with it.
I think in light of the question, though, that's something we did feel last year, was that the foot soldiers were getting digested. And Noam, what is it that you learned about these technologies? We just call them these technologies for simplicity, that you didn't know last year and you wish you didn't know now.
I want to bring attention to maybe what I read from the newsletter from Adobe, where they were like advertising about their AI feature that they, I think, added not too long ago to all their products, like ranging from Photoshop, InDesign, Premiere. And what they wrote in the newsletter was that these functions promises the quantifiable increase of productivity. And like what this promise entails, like I think every single word that consists of the statement requires more debate, let's say. Like, what does it mean for the productivity, the increase of productivity to be quantifiable? What is productivity? Like, what is the increase of it? And I still hesitate to say that I have a very profound response to these questions, but I think at least a year that I spent after the release of those feature and the publishing of that statement gave me more room to reflect on what that means and what that entails for maintaining a creative practice as a working class, self-employed individual.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating that Adobe kind of, you know, relatively quietly introduced all these kind of facilities to their suite of tools. And the previous wave of what they'd done was to make it subscription-based instead of having it you owning individual copies. And I feel the relationship between those two developments is also kind of telling in a way. Joanna, what's your bad learnings?
My bad learning? I have one, actually. It's quite bad. I found out recently that just towards the end of 2023, the OpenAI app DALL-E pitched the American government to develop their battlefield management systems. So the kind of the way that art and creativity is linked to power and colonialism, it's always been a thing when you look at art from the past, but it's very, very on the surface now. I'm always thinking about how we can kind of think about what gets called artificial intelligence in creative terms. And it keeps coming back to questions of ethics. And I don't always want making art to always be about questions of ethics, because, you know, there are other things we can think about, but it's absolutely impossible not to think about this sort of thing now.
I really appreciate you for bringing attention to this. I recall like Fred Moten writing, it is impossible to discuss like whatever like object-oriented ontology, like material philosophy, without bringing attention to that transatlantic slave trade was the very first transportation of body as things. And I think this also applies to our conversation, like that AI is currently being deployed for the genocide that has been ongoing for more than a year. I think it is, I feel the impossibility of furthering the conversation without either bringing proper attention to this or like acknowledging that this is the very like ground premise of like whatever conversation that we're going to have about AI today. And
it's not entirely separate that ethics is often the area in which the conversation is growing. But Leon, I wanted to talk about the work that you've been working on more recently, which is a kind of like using machine learning tools to foreground a kind of an environmental concern, an approach to the climate emergency. You know, which is something we'll unpack, but that's sort of taking and giving, because one of the discourses that really emerged in the last year was the sort of environmental impact of processing the in data centers and so forth, which I think did not even come up as a mention in last year's debate. But tell us about how you're addressing that.
Yeah. I suppose it's impossible to think about like using any of the pre-trained models without thinking about the sunken carbon that's in them and the costs that are associated with them. I think we're kind of in a golden era of using free tools at the moment without thinking about them. Like it's like when, you know, Airbnb and Uber used to be cheap, we're spending, you know, investors' money. They were trying to, you know, do the land grab for the thing. So we're having a great time spending their money at the moment, but it will kind of come back to thing. But the piece that you mentioned is called Imagined Islands, and it's imagining kind of climate change on the scale of an island form. So I was on the Aran Islands, and some artists who were there asked, they gave people this white sheet of paper and asked them to draw a map of Ireland. And so everyone from the mainland drew the outline of Ireland and the Aran Islands, and everyone who's from the islands drew every island around the edge, because they understand, they see things at that scale. So change to them happens if part of the island falls into the sea. That's, you know, maybe 1%. If it happens in, you know, a continent, you don't really notice it so much. So it was a way to look at climate change on the scale of an island. So I trained again on all of the islands in Ireland and Denmark, because they were the funding countries. If any other countries want to be included, you can hit me. And so it ran on a server that we used, which was ostensibly it uses green energy.
Had done a kind of carbon accounting as part of the project.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like I was like, we have solar panels at home. So I was very much like, this is hopefully a relatively offset green project. And so that ran about 1,000 cycles, and then it kind of started, you know, I made a linear interpolation of it. So it imagines all of these island landscapes that appear and disappear. And in the installation version of it, there's a tracking camera. And so it sits in an idle state. And as someone comes in, it starts to move and dream. And then when someone else comes in, it multiplies. And it multiplies until it gets very uncomfortable and starts skipping it and gets very loud and people want to leave. And one of the funders commented that, why are we trying to get people to leave the exhibition? And I was like, well, it gets uncomfortable because climate change is uncomfortable. It's not comfortable to be in, you know, Rome in July when it's 42 degrees, you know, so we have to make people feel uncomfortable maybe to understand that. You know, what the guys are saying is really, really important about, like, you know, a lot of these technologies are being used for commerce, for war, for different things. And as artists, we often take those and repurpose them. Like bent plywood came out of like Second World War plane development, and then the Eames made chairs out of it. So just because something is developed for a nefarious purpose doesn't exclude us, I think, from using it. I think as artists, as designers, we can allow people in to understand it, so then they can see when, you know, it's being used for nefarious purposes, you know, so it sometimes puts a lens on it, reflects it back, and I think that's a really important step.
Well, I do think quite a lot about the kinds of everyday creativity that people who don't see themselves as artists engage in, for instance, on DALL-E or other generative technologies, where they're in fact using them for so-called for free, but they're actually training the technologies, which can then go on to be used in different circumstances. They can be sold for commerce and, you know, indeed for war. So there's a kind of extent to which art or certainly creativity is a kind of front for some of these more lucrative uses that are being developed. And that's a kind of very difficult thing. I'm very interested in how the idea of creativity, and particularly the idea of fun, they're just right at the forefront of the development of these more sinister uses of the same technologies.
Yeah, it came up yesterday where you had this idea of the hedon, the kind of unit of pleasure which we would use to assess all the things we were interacting with. If I could stay with you, Joanna, you've been talking a lot about amateurism, and notably on Culture File, about how amateurism intersects with this particular area. And I would advise, if anybody has missed out, there's a series of essays by Joanna on amateurism as it hits this technological world, which I think is essential listening. But I wondered, you know, that again is in the past year, how I think quite positive view of amateurism and your reconfiguring of the term, even how that has been affected by what has happened in the year.
Well, yes, those essays are work towards a book specifically about amateur creativity online, which will be published next year by Verso Books. And yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this extraordinary and unprecedented opportunity, not only an opportunity for creativity, but a kind of creativity tax that has been integral to the expansion of the internet. It's enabled people who didn't have the contacts, the education, the money to enter the art world, indeed the world of literature, we're talking about the world of creativity in general, to make things. I think what's happened recently, and a particularly good book on this is by Cory Doctorow, who coined the term enshittification, which is really about how platforms started demanding not only creativity from their users, but actual money. So people are paying to view and to create themselves. It's just suddenly like a kind of double-ended idea to make profits that these platforms have suddenly got. So amateurism is being eroded online, and this amateur creativity that has flowered in an extraordinary way and allowed people to make things who may never have had the opportunity to make things, to connect on an international scale, to make works of real importance, which have often had a kind of veneer of triviality that means they haven't been taken as seriously as they might have been. That's being eroded.
But it's becoming harder and harder to break through, because there is so much, you know, content farm generation sort of pieces, you know, like people liking AI photos, like, you know, slop on Facebook that they don't realize it isn't real. So for people who, you know, I don't know if like amateur, like they don't get paid for what they do, or they haven't been trained, I'm not sure what way, but it's harder for someone to kind of break through this kind of age of like average that's in it, you know, like all of the pre-trained models, like they're just like, it's trying to give you an average, and if you're okay with being average, then they're really great tools. But if you want to be something above average, then you're going to have to kind of, you know, fight through that. There was a piece in Grayson Perry's book. He talked about these Russian artists. They hired a marketing firm to ask people what sort of art they liked and what sort of colors they liked, and would they prefer landscape or would they prefer a thing? And they called it people's choice. And every time they'd paint the piece based on what it was, always a landscape with a blue sky, some trees, and some people in the foreground. And that's really, you know, it's just really bad, average stuff. And, you know, that's what a lot of the pre-trained models are trying to do, that. They're trying to be in that age of average sort of piece. People should want more. You know, they should want to create something. And it's that, like, I think that's what the best artists do, that they strive to make something that's like really breaking through. And it's kind of getting, it's getting harder, say, like with the AI slop that's there to break through those parts.
I think there is an opportunity here. It's a difficult opportunity, but it's there. And, you know, because the kinds of art that you're talking about are fairly conventional forms. It's the idea of like visual art is a painting, written art is maybe a novel. And as AI gets better and better at imitating those traditional forms more closely, then we have to think, what is art? Yeah. And even at an amateur level, as you said, people who are thinking of art in a less kind of professional way, obviously people who have come from, you know, and arts education have been thinking about art in terms of things like systems and responses for a very long time now, you know, across the 20th century. But it's an opportunity for that kind of production, because, you know, things like a novel and a painting, they're so often a production, and they're very, very closely associated with the Industrial Revolution, with the Industrial Age. It's kind of expanding the idea of art not being something you hang on your wall, something you pick up and, you know, open like a book. There is an opportunity to direct an understanding of what can be produced as art to something else, and hopefully also to kind of decenter it from centers of commercial and political power and just say, okay, maybe art is what we can create locally, or maybe art is what we can create with some quite lo-fi tools or with relationships between people.
I think like Charlie Brooker, when he's talking about his amazing series Black Mirror, is kind of often using these speculative tools, these imagined futures that we have, and he described it as weak people using powerful tools that leads to chaos. That's basically the model for what it is. So, I'm not saying people are weak using pre-trained sort of things, but sometimes people using things leads to chaos. You know, using powerful tools when they don't know, you know, what the outcome. And I think we're kind of in that kind of part where there is a lot of like slop, a lot of stuff
very chaotic though. It looks very closely controlled, and it looks like something that people are being instructed to stay within some lines. People are being, and you know, it would be nice if there could be kind of ways to just reject that.
I'm interested in the way, you know, we've talked a little bit about how you would use the tools in your process in artistic production. But one of the kind of the affordances here is kind of away from production. But that may be as interesting as using the tools to actually produce work. But how do they fit in with your life in a way that you find useful? Anybody could take that, but Leon smiled the best, so.
You were talking about productivity before, and it makes people more productive, but you don't get to go home. Like, it's like, oh, I'm more productive, done all that work in half a day, can I have the afternoon off? It's that's not necessary. We're still on this, you know, like Ford, like 40-hour week sort of situation that we have. So it's like, you know, just because you went from a typewriter to a keyboard doesn't mean you could, you know, knock out 3 reports a week so you could go up to 6. Our work didn't get less. So we really have to kind of think about like what's a post-work life going to be, or environment. And you know, if it can take away that hardship, I think if it takes away the toil from people's day, that's brilliant. And like speaking about design, I can just see the typography sort of piece over there. It's Herman Zaff, who's like a typographer, was saying that like computers will come and free us from the dust of the past, because he didn't want to carve letter forms anymore. He's very happy to, you know, switch over to start drawing stuff on it. So if it can like free us of toil and the dust of the past, I think it's brilliant if it can do that, as long as you get to go home, right? As long as you get to go and do the other things that we have, like this post-work environment. If it just makes you do more work, then it's not really serving the purpose, yeah.
I guess in economic terms, it's the same question as like, where is the surplus going? Who gets that?
Well, there are certain jobs that can't be mechanized, and they're mostly jobs to do with care. And it would be really interesting if that meant that these jobs speculatively, optimistically, utopianly became the most highly paid and sought after jobs because, you know, things like producing documents, maybe even producing art, could just be done by machine.
I think the movement that was exemplified the most was during the pandemic, ironically, where these workers are classified as the essential workers. But it's also, I mean, what I meant by an irony is that they were the ones who were directly exposed to the danger.
But they weren't paid better.
Exactly.
And also, you know, a lot of things like homeschooling tended to default to basically to women. So people who were more precariously employed and lower paid were more likely to be doing the care jobs at home. But let's be utopian.
I wanted to bring the AI into, you know, bring some of its discourse into this conversation. So I was asked it a question, and I thought, well, I would like to discuss that with my panelists. So I'm intrigued by this idea that one of the possibilities in a technology that is strong on pattern recognition would be to see the affordances of our world around us that we haven't added up. Not necessarily the affordance of extraction, but the affordances of recombination. and that maybe there is an ethical use of these tools in that. So I asked Claude, my favorite brand, what is the single most obvious innovation in design that is possible but humans haven't noticed yet? Which I think is my question for all designers. Here, the answer, here's my speculation, a systemic approach to reverse localization in design. Elaborate. Traditional localization adapts designs for different cultural contexts, but what if we flip this? AI could help us identify and extract, dangerous word, unique design patterns, metaphors, and solutions from diverse cultural contexts that could improve design globally. Right now, most global design flows from dominant tech cultures outwards, but we have the computational power and pattern recognition capabilities to systematically study, catalog, and meaningfully incorporate design innovations from historically marginalized design cultures into mainstream practice. Just, I'd like to you all to respond to that. Like, have you come across that idea? What's feeding that idea? No.
I think what Claude described sounds oddly similar to what these international funding policies of, you know, institutions are seemingly promising to do. And I think what this proposal shares in common with what I observe in those funding systems is this aspect of extraction, indeed, to expand the frontier of cultural production to ever marginal area, to submerge those in the production of surplus of culture and information in the cultural practice.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's striking in the philosophy is there anything else to extract? And in using the discourse of, you know, like, giving value to marginalized communities, it actually offers to extract from them. I think that's kind of what you're suggesting now.
Just because your work is accessible to more people doesn't mean it's good. You know, it's doing that. It sounds like a commerce thing, or it's like, you know, and it happens in arts policy as well. It's like, what impact are you going to have? What communities are you going to reach? It's like, I'm going to make something and only a few people are going to like it and a lot of people are going to hate it. But it's going to be interesting, you know. Like when we made Dwelling last year, Peter wrote an opera for the first act and people walked out, you know, because they didn't know what was going on. I was like, that's brilliant. I can't believe someone walked out of our show. You know, it's like, that was much better than people coming up and going like, that was really, you know, it was okay. And I kind of, you know, it's like porridge. I didn't really think much of it, you know. So you kind of, it sounds like a very like trained on a commerce response, doesn't it? It's just like, we're going to get more people to see your design by making it more accessible to everyone in the world. Like, it doesn't really, you know.
Representation not being liberation.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like design Esperanto, you know, because design is a language, but it's not only one language, it's a series of languages, and particular kind of local design languages are of immense value. And perhaps if Claude's kind of dreams came true, then the kind of lingua franca wouldn't erase these languages. But, you know, we know from the history of several European languages becoming on the whole lingua franca for the whole world, that it's a very dangerous thing to engage in.
I do get the feeling there that Claude did give us a little poke, which was kind of interesting. Like, our kind of somatic response to this interloper is quite, you know, quite stirring in some ways. A fascinating panel once more again this year. I would like to thank Leon Butler, Noam Young-Ratson, and Joanna Walsh, all of whom contributed fantastically here today, live and in person, without any algorithmic and AI assistance. Hopefully that won't become a rarity. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.